In 1966, in my first year as a postgraduate at Merton College, Oxford, I occupied a tiny college room in the attic of a house at 21 Merton Street. It was austere but romantic. There were views of Magdalen Tower, the bells of which kept me awake at night, and it was exceedingly cold. I outraged my college scout by keeping my two-bar electric fire on all night. Apparently, central heating was bad for you. I was surprised to hear a few years later that the equally uncongenial suite of rooms directly below mine had been allocated to their new inhabitant, J.R.R. Tolkien, the retired Merton professor of English language and literature. His wife Edith had recently died, and he'd moved back to college to finish his final book, The Silmarillion. I would have thought, he must have been exceedingly rich by then, that something more comfortable might have been found, but he was apparently happy in his years there. He was a decent, shambling old chap, an unlit pipe in his mouth, and a look of vague distance in his eye. Presumably he was internally on a visit to the past, or lost somewhere in his fictional Middle Earth, lost in epic musing. Tolkien was as near to a celebrity, in the modern sense, as Merton College had ever produced. Max Beerbohm was a Mertonian, and so was T.S. Eliot, but neither of them ever received sacks of fan mail or crowds of visitors merely seeking a glimpse, or better yet, an autograph. At weekends, a small throng of colorful hairy creatures would coagulate and gawp outside 21 Merton Street, looking like extras from a filming of The Hobbit itself. They looked as if they came from California, but in fact, they might have come from anywhere, because the world had gone Tolkien mad. The Lord of the Rings trilogy had been completed to great acclaim in 1955. But it had, as it were, been reinvented in the 60s, and everyone I knew had read it. It was enchanting, an unexpected combination of sublimity, erudition, and whimsy that meshed perfectly with the spirit of the times. It was terrific to read if you were stoned, and, improbably enough, Tolkien had joined the Beatles, Andy Warhol, and Timothy Leary as stars of the psychedelic firmament. By the end of 1966, an American newspaper reported that at Yale the trilogy was selling faster than Lord of the Flies, and at Harvard it was outpacing Catcher in the Rye. A psychedelic magazine called Gandalf's Garden circulated in San Francisco, and all around the world one could see the children of the 60s in Frodo Lives baseball caps. Tolkien was more than a little bemused by the fuss, and referred ironically to my deplorable cultus.
When fame actually hit him in the form of, well, Bobby's Oxing, he was puzzled and didn't like it very much. I don't think anybody would, really. I mean, he used to be woken up at 2 in the morning when you're getting on in years on the transatlantic phone, asked foolish questions because the time lag hadn't been realised. When your rose garden is trodden on by tourists who come in to take photographs through your own window when you're eating breakfast, and this sort of thing, it was worrying.
The late Rainer Unwin, who was at this time Tolkien's publisher. I'd read and reread the trilogy, and then I went backwards in time and read The Hobbit, which had been published in 1937. It was simpler, more obviously aimed at children, but it was equally charming. I wouldn't wish to reread the books today. I suspect they'd now seem too arch, maybe a bit snobbish and mannered, somewhat pedantic. I enjoyed a lot of things then that would now seem a little jejune. But what I regret is not that I read Tolkien's books with such enthusiasm, but that I didn't get him to sign them for me. At the time, you could still get first editions of Lord of the Rings for some reasonable multiple of their original published prices, while A Hobbit in its dust wrapper might have set you back £50, maybe a little more. I knew nothing of first editions at the time, and if you'd told me I was going to spend a good part of my adult life dealing in them, I would have been astonished and horrified. Who cared about what edition you read? It was content that mattered, and a sturdy paperback was always going to be preferable to a hardback, easier to carry around, less bother. I don't think I'd even heard of first editions. And if I had, and even if I'd had one, I don't think I would have asked Professor Tolkien to sign it. It was curious that he should have ended his writing life with The Silmarillion, because that was where it began. He was, in both his academic and fictional work, an endless tinkerer and reviser, who would rather put something aside than publish it in less than perfect state. The book, a dark and ambitious saga, had been conceived in the 1920s and had partly sprung, as all of his work did, from stories that he told his young children. His eldest son, John Tolkien, remembered.
One particularly remembers the stories my father told me, because I never could sleep at night, and so he came and told me stories. And this, I think, helped to lead in to the fact that what he was thinking about and writing from a much earlier period ended in being The Hobbit, which was really told as stories at Christmas. We used to have two or three chapters, which must have been written in the late 1920s. Each Christmas we sort of sat down and had part of it. And if we were very lucky, we got two or three more stories for more chapters, and that's why The Hobbit is written in the form of a separate adventure in each chapter, because each chapter was had either a year or 2 years between them. In a good Christmas, we might get two new chapters.
It began, like so much creative work seems to, a little mysteriously.
I wrote it as a relief from examining a school certificate, as it was then called. One of the candidates had mercifully left one of the pages with no writing on it, which is the best thing that could possibly happen to an examiner. And I wrote on it, in a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit. The names always generate a story in my mind. Eventually I thought I'd better find out what hobbits were like.
What they were like, he later reflected, was himself, Rainer Unwin.
He says in a piece of paper, which I've got here, I am in fact a hobbit in all but size. I like gardens, trees, unmechanized farmlands. I smoke a pipe and like good plain food, unrefrigerated, but detest French cooking. I like and even dare to wear in these dull days ornamental waistcoats. I'm fond of mushrooms out of a field. Have a very simple sense of humour, which even my appreciative critics find tiresome. I go to bed late and get up late when possible.
Hobbits were simple, rustic Englishmen, though shorter and with hairy feet, of limited imaginative range in their daily lives, but capable, when moved, of great courage and resourcefulness, a lesson that Tolkien had certainly learned while serving in the First War. His friend and colleague, Neville Coghill.
I asked Ronald Tolkien how it was that he came to invent this whole complex, this continent of languages and peoples, and he said, well, I first got interested in the Shire and the Hobbit as a picture of the kind of nice, simple, modest Englishman that he just had been working with in the army.
I've always been impressed. We are here surviving because of the indomitable courage of quite small people against impossible odds, jungles, volcanoes, wild beasts. They struggle on, almost blindly in a way.
Tolkien began typing the story in the first years of the 1930s, but didn't feel able to finish it, though various friends like C.S. Lewis were shown the manuscript. It might well have lain unregarded in some drawer had not one of his postgraduate students, Elaine Griffiths, recommended that he send it to the publishers, Allen and Unwin.
Professor Tolkien lent me his, not manuscript, but beautifully typed copy of The Hobbit. He had a fascinating typewriter with an italic script. And I thought it was wonderful and read it with enormous pleasure. And quite a time afterwards, somebody I'd known when she was an undergraduate who was working for Allen and Unwin came to me and wanted something, I've forgotten what, and I said, oh, Susan, I don't know it or can't get it, but I'll tell you something. Go along to Professor Tolkien and see if you can get out of him a work called The Hobbit. Because I think it's frightfully good. Now, she was a very attractive young woman. Not only was she good to look at, but she had a delightful voice. And I thought, now, if anyone can get this out of Tolkien, it'll be Susan. So off she went to see him, and sure enough, she got The Hobbit.
Seeing promise in the manuscript, Unwin gave it to his 10-year-old son, Rainer.
I normally read children's books that were submitted to this publishing firm. My father used to pay me 1 shilling for my reports, and that was the fee I got when I reported on The Hobbit. It wasn't a very good report, actually. I read it the other day and was rather ashamed, but it was just good enough to not only get me my fee, but get the book published, and that was the important thing.
Rayner had said that the book didn't need illustrations, but his father disagreed and commissioned Tolkien, who was a talented amateur artist, to provide the illustrations and a design for the dust wrapper. Though Tolkien was modest about his abilities, "The pictures seemed to me only to prove that the author cannot draw," he said. "His perfect dust wrapper illustration continues to this day to adorn the book and adds considerably to its charm, not to mention its value on a first edition. Colored in blue, green, and black, it depicts a forest in the foreground, with snow-capped mountains behind and a blue and white sky in which dragons are swooping." On the borders of the dust wrapper are Tolkien's runic lettering in Elvish, which have a magical air and which translated spell out the full title of the book, The Hobbit, or There and Back Again, being the record of a year's journey made by Bilbo Baggins, compiled from his memoirs by J.R.R. Tolkien, and published by George Allen and Unwin. If you're unfamiliar with Elvish, Tolkien spoke it like this.
Ar Elbereth Glilfoniel, Sidivren Penamiriel o Menel Aglar Elenath, Nahaired Palandiriel o Galadhrem.
The book was published in September of 1937 in an edition of 1,500 copies, reprinted within a few months, and has never been out of print since. It is one of the most sought after of all children's books, and nice copies preserving that superb dust wrapper can now fetch something in the region of £25,000. Oh, the follies of youth, the missed opportunities, the books uninscribed. By the time that I met him, so great were the demands of strangers that Tolkien would only sign books for friends or for Merton men. It would have been so easy to pop in with a pile of first editions, and if I'd kept my inscribed copies, they would provide the making of a comfortable old age. Tolkien prices over the last couple of years have risen astronomically quicker than the NASDAQ index, partly, I guess, in anticipation of the film version of Lord of the Rings. An inscribed Hobbit? Perhaps £75,000. An inscribed Lord of the Rings? Maybe £50,000. Mind you, I never sell books inscribed to me, so I guess I would leave them to my children. They'd sell them in a second, sensible things. Which would you rather have, an inscribed Hobbit or a cottage in Tuscany? I know which one they'll choose. As for me, give me a good inscribed book any day.